on a minute. Right, there you go. So, welcome, Ali, and I'll hand the meeting over to you.
Okay, thank you so much, Jan, and thank you for asking me. Normally, I'm pretty nervous for these things, but I just feel so comfortable with you guys that it seems different. And congrats on your 6 months. The first home group I ever had, it gave us coins at 30 days, 90 days, 6 months, and 1 year. And that 6 month coin just I could not stop sobbing. I just couldn't believe that I was actually doing it. I had known I was an alcoholic for years before I got to AA, and everyone around me knew I was an alcoholic. I started drinking alcoholically in my late 20s, which always surprises me because I had my first drink many years prior, but the desire to be a good girl weighed out, or outweighed the desire to not be present in my mind. I had always n needed something, even as a small girl. I was keenly aware of the fact that something wasn't quite normal with me, and I was keenly aware that my living conditions were highly abnormal. I grew up for the first part of my life in Southeast Texas. There's seven of us kids from a bunch of different marriages, but my mom is very, very ill, very mentally ill. And she's never complied with any kind of treatment. So it's hard to say what her exact diagnosis is, but she's been diagnosed with both schizoid personality and borderline disorder. And she has a lot of paranoia and periods of mania. And she doesn't really live in reality. So she never should have had any children, but she had a slew. And she, my father, left our family without any warning when I was four. And my mother promptly married an addict. And so between my mom and my dad, or my mom and my stepdad, neither one of them was able to hold a job. We were hungry, basically. We were hungry all the time and dirty, and everything was broken, and the house was filled with millions and millions of roaches. There were so many roaches that they were in my headboard at night. They would get in my ears if I didn't cover my head with a sheet. And to this day, I cover my head with a sheet. There were roaches in the cereal box. There were roaches in the fridge. The toilet never, it was just a horrible, it was a horrible way to grow up. I remember reading in the big book about the four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair, and kind of being floored because I thought, yeah, that's been the way it's been in my head for as long as I could remember. But for me, there was a prominent, and still is a prominent, fifth horseman, and that's humiliation and shame. It's been a theme that's been repeated throughout my life, and has just affected me enormously. I'm still somewhat tormented by it, but it's much better than it was. And it started off with feelings of shame around what I now know is being neurodivergent, but at the time, of course, I had no idea. And then the shame around, everyone knew how bad our house was. And so that was shameful. My mom had a very bad episode when I started high school, and she left with the other kids and left me and my stepfather, but didn't tell us that she was leaving. And something happened to me mentally. Even though she and I never got along, it was still incredibly, it shattered me mentally. And I had, I guess you would say, I decompensated. And I was not safe to stay in that house even one night. So I left. And I was 14. And I didn't speak to or see my mother for several years after that. But I lived with a substitute teacher for a few months and tracked down my father, who was up north. And he sent me a plane ticket. And when I got off the plane, I didn't even know what he looked like. But when I went to his apartment, I just felt like I'd hit the lottery. Because his apartment was so sunny and clean, and there was food in the fridge. But the problem was that he was a minimalist, and he didn't have any furniture or anything on the walls. He didn't have a bed, nothing. He had a sleeping bag and a Coleman heater. But I didn't give a shit because it was clean and there was food. I always thought that school was going to be the way I got out of, my life. And for a while, that was true. I went to a good college, and I didn't drink nearly as much as my peers did. I would never recommend to anyone that they do what I did in college, but I basically didn't have any fun and I just did my studies. And so, I graduated at the top of my class practically. But it was a terrible, terrible way to go through college because I was so stressed all the time. After college, I had some of the best years. And I studied anthropology in college, and I wanted to be a medical anthropologist. So I had a couple years of doing medical anthropology field work. And one year was in South India, and another year was in Papua New Guinea. And I absolutely loved and still love being someplace where nobody knows me. And what happens to me when I'm in a place where nobody knows me is I become really adventurous and really outgoing, and I try all sorts of new things, and I'm not afraid. But when you put me in Pittsburgh and I have to take a city bus, I can't do it. And I have it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. I have trouble going to the grocery store. I have trouble going to the bank. I have in this environment, I have so much trouble, but I don't know. After my field work, I went to med school. I got into this prestigious med school, And I thought that I was flying high. But I had my very first, well, I had my first very, very serious episode with agoraphobia. And I had, depression had been creeping and creeping and creeping ever since I had that breakdown when I was young. But I think all the stress of med school, whatever, I stopped going to class. I couldn't get to class. I couldn't get to the mailbox. It was it's so unexplainable. I couldn't leave my room. I couldn't get out of bed. And I just I quit. And there was tremendous, tremendous humiliation around that. I had a very serious suicide attempt, and I ended up in on a psych unit at Yale New Haven Hospital, where my classmates were doing rotations through the psych unit. And why they didn't keep them from going in my room, I should have been protected, but it wasn't long after that that I started drinking daily. It helped, it helped for a while. I met my husband. He had finished his doctorate in organic chemistry and had his first job. And he was already a very bad alcoholic, but somehow he managed to get his PhD. And we were just instantly drawn to each other. It was just magnetic. Both of us so incredibly unhealthy. And we just descended into a nightmare. But of course, we thought we were making good decisions. We got married, had a child. And at that point, I thought, I knew I was an alcoholic, but I thought that if I had a child, it would slow me down, which is insane. I wasn't able to quit drinking for my pregnancy. I could slow down a little bit, but I was never honest with the doctors. And so my son had some medical issues while he was growing. And he has some diagnoses, and we'll never know if that's because I drank or those just happen sometimes. But he has autism and ADHD and OCD and generalized anxiety. So, some of that could be genetic. My husband and I, we had a normal looking house. After I left medical school, I tried to have a different career, and for a while it went really well, even though I was drinking pretty badly. But I became a manuscript editor, and I loved that. I absolutely loved that. I was editing textbooks, and my colleagues were just wonderful people, and they were very supportive and very, they wanted me so badly to get help. Eventually, I left that job before they fired me. And things just went downhill for such a long time. It baffles me to this day why we let things get as bad as they did. We never hit our son, but we neglected him. He was terribly, terribly neglected. And even as a toddler, I repeated my mom's patterns. He was not fed properly. We didn't put him to bed. We didn't bathe him. You know, we passed out and he fell asleep forever. And he would routinely pull a chair up to the freezer and open it and get ice cream out. And then in the morning, we'd find ice cream on the kitchen floor. Sometimes I would hear him wailing, "Help me. Why can't somebody help me?" And I was in that state where, you know, you're too drunk to move, but you can hear what's going on. You try to move, but you can't. It torments me. My husband was a very, very violent drunk. I was a very slutty drunk. So it was a terrible combination. I'm not trying to beat myself up. That's just the way it was. We had legal problems from DUIs and from the violence. I had medical issues because I was so sick, and I had pancreatitis twice. And I was terribly, terribly, terribly skinny. We had financial problems, and eventually, what happened was what we knew what was going to happen, and we lost custody of Sebastian. And when that happened, that night that that happened in the jail cell, decompensated again. And it's very hard to explain what happened, but it's like your brain just explodes. And you lose touch with reality. That was the best thing that could have happened, absolute best thing that could have happened. Because I had wanted to quit drinking for years, but I didn't think that I could live without alcohol. And when a doctor or a judge or a nurse or colleague said to me, "How can you do this? Don't you love your son?" I would think, "Don't you know the two aren't related?" You know? But something happened that night in the jail cell, and it wasn't the first time I'd been in a jail cell. But you know, that desperation was such a gift. And even though I had tried AA meetings before, and I was on antabuse, I mean, I tried all sorts of things. I just thought how absolutely preposterous that sitting in a church basement talking about this stuff is going to help me stay away from a drink. But I tried. And the first few months was excruciating, absolutely excruciating. It wasn't just detoxing from alcohol, it was the obsession. It was so hard to exist for months, and then it lifted. And one day I realized through tears that I hadn't actually thought about alcohol for a couple hours. My mind was just blown. And you know, it was really good that Sebastian, we didn't have custody of him, because for those 15 months that he wasn't home, while it was like losing a limb and it was incredibly painful, it allowed us to go to tons and tons and tons of meetings and just work on getting well. So I had 15 months of sobriety, and then when he was returned to us, it should have been like the happiest time. But instead, it was incredibly painful because he came home and I was faced with how disturbed a child he was without alcohol. And it was so hard. He didn't want to be in the same room with either of us. He constantly checked our glasses. He was terrified to go anywhere because, I mean, we had had several accidents with him in the back seat. We had driven cross country in absolute blind drunkenness with him in the back seat screaming. We had passed out with him. Just so many horrible things happened. So when he came home, I just decided, it's not that I thought, oh, I'm not an alcoholic. I decided I'm just going to leave the two of them behind and I'm just going to drink and they're better off without me. But somehow, I got to my last rehab and I've stayed sober since. And that was July 10th of 2006. So I just had my 18th anniversary. And for many years, I can honestly say that I loved AA. I didn't love the steps, I didn't love the program. But I loved hearing from other people who drank like I did and got better and didn't need to drink anymore. That's what I loved. I would hear people say all the time, oh, I don't want to hear any drunkalogs. I wanted to hear drunkalogs because I didn't trust that you guys drank like I did. I was the person who threw up in my mouth and made sure I didn't lose any of it. Because I needed it. I got really into the big book. I got really into the rest of the literature. I sponsored women and was a veritable big book thumper. And the whole time I was lying because I didn't believe any of it. And finally, I got so disturbed by that chasm between what I believed and my behavior. That chasm is just so deadly inside. And I found secular AA, and I've just been. I'm just so renewed. I'm so happy to know that other people are living healthy, happy lives without all that stuff. In sobriety, I've found all sorts of joys. The biggest one, of course, is getting my family back. I'm not slutty anymore, and my husband isn't violent anymore. And some people would say, that it's terrible to stay with somebody who is so violent. But let me tell you, he is a changed man, the same way that I am changed. We don't live in the same place. We see each other on weekends, but we have tremendous love for each other. And our son is thriving. And I'm down here in Florida with him, getting him ready to leave the nest, I mean, he's left the nest, but he's going to graduate school, and he and I have an amazing relationship. And he's hilarious. And we just have so much fun together. And I don't sponsor now. I don't want a sponsor. Maybe someday in the future. I don't have a sponsor. Maybe one day in the future with a secular woman, you know. My husband is getting used to me being in secular AA. It is threatening for him because he doesn't understand that people really do recover in secular AA. He's not a God person so much, but he loves AA. Life is so good. There's a quote, if I can get it right, and I don't remember the author, but it says, "It's only when I peer into the abyss into which I climbed that I can peer out and see the depths to which I soar." And that to me is my journey, even though I hate that word journey, but that's what it's been, you know. I had to go down to this really, really, really dark place to be so grateful for everything that happens now. So thank you, Dan. That's enough. And hopefully I can hear some of what you guys think.